Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be talking about the development of a Victorian and Edwardian women's press, particularly a women's press focused around suffrage and the campaign for suffrage. The reason why I'm going to talk about this is as I think it's important to look beyond the conventional images of women's suffrage that we have, which are brought to us by the popularisation of the suffragette movement, and to look at kind of almost like the long tail of the suffrage movement, which was a steady development throughout the 19th century of ideas, debates, discourses, and arguments. And you can normally find these things in the various magazines and periodicals and pamphlets that were being published. And you can also see very interesting shifts and changes in trends and attitudes and opinions over time. And these sorts of gradual shifts help us to make sense of the radicalism of the pre-war years. There's currently generally being rather mythologized and mystified in films such as the current one out about the suffragettes. Should take with a healthy pinch of salt if I were you. Okay, so between about the 1850s and the 1930s, there was a vibrant and popular women's political press in Britain, and it developed and grew really as the Reform Acts of 1867, 1883 and 1884 and 1918 expanded suffrage rights predominantly for men. And it evolved from the existing body of writing for women, or journalism, if you will, for women, that was done in the first half of the 19th century, that was written predominantly by men for women. Most of the kind of the periodicals for women before about 1850 were written for wealthy, educated, middle-class ladies, and it was written by men, and it was handy hints on how to arrange for domestic service, how to make sure your husband was happy, and how to deal with the staff. So it was a kind of a periodical about the dilemmas that wealthy middle-class women faced in the world of kind of Victorian bourgeois society and what to do about that. The classic of its kind, I suppose, is Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management, again, which has been popularised in subsequent decades as the first great, you know, recipe book, if you will. And it wasn't. It was a book about social class. Mrs. Beaton's Guide to Managing the Household was really about making sure that you picked the best staff and you got them to do what you wanted. And managing a Victorian household for a bourgeois Victorian lady was quite quite an art. Interestingly, that book is published in 1861. And the laws surrounding, you know, publication and censorship relaxed in the 1850s. And so it is the first main book about, household management and that kind of thing. Obviously, really, in every way, kind of hardly the kind of political tracks that we're going to talk about. But it was the first one to be published by a woman. So in the second half of the 19th century, when press laws are relaxed, the profusion of new texts and publications, newspapers, that kind of thing is quite remarkable. There seems to be a huge pent-up energy for expressing new political ideas. And these papers, pamphlets, leaflets, booklets, and this whole sort of new world of publishing is expressly politicised. And it really reflects the fact that women are treated as, obviously, as second-class citizens in Victorian society, particularly as it comes to their children and their property. There are women who fall foul of divorce law, who lose everything when, even when the husband is at fault in the divorce through infidelity, women who experience domestic violence, women who are terrified to leave the matrimonial home because they may never see their children again. And the beginnings of suffrage kind of coalesce around this one concept that women will only be able, women of means particularly, will only be able to have full and equal property rights, particularly over the issue of divorce, if they have representation. And it is women of means that are ladies who are at the forefront of this new wave of women's publishing. They're the ones with the ability to finance it. They've got the education and the capital behind them in order to do this. And the first major publication that focused on women's legal rights was published by Barbara Bodekin, and it was called the English Women's Journal. And it was began in 1858, and she was an integral figure in the early suffrage movement and a campaigner against the divorce laws. And she had one of the first people to articulate through her works that the only full representation, only the vote, could ever fully protect women's rights before the courts. In 1854, for example, she wrote a devastating critique of the existing divorce laws, and she called it a brief summary of the laws of England concerning women. It took till 1882, mind, for the findings of this article to evolve into the Married Women's Property Act, which finally established women's rights to property post-divorce. And initially, the issue of suffrage is approached indirectly. It's too much of a political hot potato to demand straight away. It is sort of hinted at, suggested and implied that women should have the vote, or things would be better for women if they did have the vote. But the focus of the English Women's Journal, in order to allow English women to be able to read it, to allow for their husbands to feel this was appropriate for their wives to read, it focused on issues surrounding the home. So the legal rights of women at home, and the desire of many women to have careers. And it reflected the aspirations really of a middle class audience, because at this time, of course, there's very little written. Only in a kind of a philanthropic way is anything written about the working classes. And the English Woman's Journal gradually morphed into the English Woman's Review in 1866. Which was then edited by Jessie Boucheret, and was now slightly more political. Interestingly, 1866 is a year of intense political activism and intense kind of violence, if you will, on the streets of most of Britain's cities on the eve of the 1867 Reform Act. the Social Democratic Federation, really sort of Britain's own sort of emergent Marxist party under the auspices of Henry Hindman, was part of a huge and violent demonstration in Hyde Park that year, demanding the vote. So these are kind of febrile political times, and it gave opportunities for women's publishing to become that little bit more politicised. I wouldn't go anywhere near calling it radical at this point, but politicised at least. And the years 1865 to 66, again, in the run-up to the Reform Act, saw a profusion of women's suffrage societies, groups like the Kensington Society, which really is the kind of the beginnings of the NUWSS, or the kind of the framework of it. The multiplicity of these new organisations seems to have injected women's writing in this period of time with a kind of a new level of outspoken confidence. Lydia Becker, for example, who was the daughter of a wealthy chemical magnate from Manchester and a scientist, established the Women's Suffrage Journal in 1870, again with Jessie Boucherie. The financial pressures that existed on these magazines meant that they were funded from the pockets of people like Lydia Becker. And so they were female-run, and they were run by middle-class women of a respectable nature, using the term as it would have been in the context at the time. And they had to obviously sell the publications, couldn't give them away, and they needed to have an effective network of vendors. And so this emerged in the guise of the Victorian and Edwardian London female newspaper street sellers, who were first seen as a novelty, you know, something that was sort of chuckled at in the Times and the Pall Mall Gazette indulgently, but then became the sort of the subjects of vitriol and criticism and anger and resentment. And this was, you know, perfect political training, really, for the future struggles to come. So many of the veteran suffragists and suffragettes by the turn of the century had spent years being heckled and sworn at in the streets for...
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Selling publications such as the various suffrage journals. As the scope of women's journalism developed, so did the subject matter grow more diverse. So issues, again, such as suffrage and property and employment rights and domestic violence were well discussed within this new world of pamphlets and periodicals. But also, social issues began to be linked to questions of women's suffrage and women's rights, and issues such as prostitution, particularly child prostitution or white slavery, and poverty began to be explored. And so ideas that connected women's suffrage to essentially socialist concepts, that there was a class perspective to be had and a social perspective to be had on the struggle for women's emancipation, started to kind of filter into this debate. Now, it must be said that there is surprisingly little social radicalism in the top echelons of the suffrage movement. As discussed before, the suffrage movement's original origins were based around establishing votes for women in order to protect women's and property women's rights. There was very little discussion of protecting the rights of working class women who were on a daily basis far more transgressed against than most wealthy ladies in polite society could possibly imagine. In the Pankhurst family, of whom we will talk about in the moment, were almost exclusively, with the exception of daughters Christabel and Adela, Sylvia and Emmeline Pankhurst were by and large interested in votes for ladies, and they are horrified when Christabel and Adela Pankhurst go to see if they can solicit the support of working class women in the East End and try to kind of raise their level of political consciousness. This was seen as entirely not the thing to do. Because as the politicisation of the women's movement in the 1890s continues apace, the idea develops that not only should property for wealthy women be protected, but also if women had a role, had the vote, they might elect their peers who might be able to run, you know, Victorian and Edwardian society in a largely more rational and efficient way. This was the kind of the view. So there was little discussion ever of social revolution. Not to say that these were hard-hearted people and they did not care about the plight of the poor. I think that would be unfair to say as well. But they viewed their duty to the poor in a traditionally Victorian philanthropic way. That, you know, the lower classes need to be kind of guided and shaped and educated and given a helping hand. But simply kept at the level that they were at in terms of political representation. In 1906, when the Liberal government comes to power, it's headed by Herbert Asquith, who has no intention of allowing women to have the vote. And this is a kind of a moment of developing militancy amongst the suffrage movement. In 1903, the Manchester Society, National Society for Women's Suffrage, which had been part of the NUWSS movement since 1897, it develops into the Women's Social and Political Union. And this is a far more militant organisation dedicated to ending the inaction over women's votes. They launched their own newspaper, Votes for Women, and it was established in 1907. It was different from its more moderate predecessors. It was funded by Emmeline and Frederick Pedick Lawrence, but for the first 2 years it had a very modest circulation. It was just 5,000 readers. The WSPU used promotional activities, such as the advertisements on a newspaper, of its newspaper on the side of London Bus. And by 1910, its circulation had leapt to 120,000 a month. It had attacked the government measures against the suffragettes during the Cat and Mouse Act, and it promoted acts of civil disobedience, which was kind of of questionable legality, promoting the breaking of the law. However, things come to a head within the WSPU. The WSPU is a very divided movement, and when the Pethick Lawrences told Christabel Pankhurst again in 1912 that plans to set fire to buildings as part of the campaign was really a step too far. She expels them from the union, from the movement, and they leave, but they leave with their newspaper. So the newspaper Votes for Women goes with them, and it kind of divides off from the WSPU. So a subsequent publication was set up called Suffragette, and it follows the Christabel's line of overtly militant actions. I'm not sure how Emmeline felt about all this, really. And it has a circulation of not quite the same as Votes for Women. It has a circulation of 10,000 a week by the eve of the war, and which shows perhaps that there was a much more limited appetite for these kinds of radical actions. But it also is profoundly transformed by the war. So not only had under the kind of the influence of the more radical, more left wing Christabel, had started to shift towards embracing voting rights for all women, so for working class women as well as middle class and respectable ladies, it begins to use images of the working classes within its within its pages to really bring to the attention of middle class ladies the plight of their social social lowers or inferiors. There were negotiations between the WSPU and the government during the war for the release of suffragettes imprisoned due to their kind of window-breaking campaigns and arson and that sort of thing, in return for an end to the protests. In 1914, the Suffragette is rebranded the Britannia and becomes a patriotic periodical, a patriotic newspaper, which is completely geared up to supporting the war effort. Part of the reasoning was that it was assumed that if the Suffragettes supported the war effort, there would be some kind of payoff after the end of the war for women in terms of suffrage. But also there was a belief that civilization was now being defended, and that unless a national effort to pull together and defeat the barbaric German horde, as it was depicted, unless that was focused on, then there were probably not going to be votes for anybody. But it also shows you a kind of weakness, really, within the editorial direction of the Suffragette. And it shows you that if there were radical roots within the Pankhurst family, that they don't run particularly deep. There are all manner of socialists, trade unionists, radicals and revolutionaries who in 1914 are either imprisoned or punished in a variety of other ways for refusing to give the war their blessing, even if it is allegedly supposed to be fought in the defence of civilization. So really the development of the women's suffrage movement can be seen through the development of these periodicals and these leaps forward, and sometimes even kind of backward, really, in radicalism and in kind of egalitarian thought. And there have been several generations of these since the 1850s onwards. There was really, up until the eve of the Second World War, still a very vibrant women's press, and perhaps this is something that dies after World War II, and discourses for women and become less of a key issue after the Second World War. After the First World War, really, because of the development of suffrage, but certainly after the Second World War, other social forces and social tensions become more prevalent. You have things like the post-war periods after 1954, really post-war periods of relative affluence, and the debates surrounding women and women's rights really emerge in the later 1960s, when you have a kind of a new waves of political activism and new waves of feminism. But once again, the extent to which these were working class discourses is very debatable indeed. Anyway, I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. It's been great to talk about something a bit different this morning, and I'll speak to you again, no doubt. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.